Well, no, wait. It's the Henry Rain Show here on WWPR 1490 AM, going back to the future, or future to the past, because we're still in search of a theme song here for the relaunch of the Henry Rain Show, but we went to the past to find the longest-running co-host, many say the best co-host, although I don't want to take sides, because none of the other co-hosts may be listening, but it's Alan Cross. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Henry, and good morning, world.
And, well, how have you been spending the last 7 years?
I'm really excited. I've been sitting at home waiting for the phone to ring, but I can't believe we're back. Actually, going back on here, we're going to be bringing you the great music of the 60s and 70s.
It's not a music show.
Oh, I thought the Beach is Radio Network. I thought we were coming back on.
No. That was your aspirations, and that never really came to pass, Alan. That's a false memory that you have.
So, I'm back to doing political talk.
Really? So I've got some community involvement, and
I put those childish fears to bed, and now I'm... We're here for the big time, man. I can just feel it.
Yeah, we're about to break through. I can tell. Coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to have big time. We're going to have the editor of BillionTimes.com, Dennis Mailing, on. But you're actually jam-packed with big time stuff.
Oh, I'm excited. I've been looking at the show prep. I read
the subject line of the email I sent you.
I finally got it open. So I'm ready. I am excited. I'm happy to be here. I'm hoping that a lot of the people who listened to us before are going to listen to us again. And, well, we just had such a cast of characters. Just some great times on the air. So I'm looking forward to this.
Well, if anybody is out there and planning on, it's already begun, the Van Buchanan Town Hall meeting at Van Rosa in Sarasota was supposed to start at 11, and I imagine it's still running. I don't have a confirmation, but we'd love to get a confirmation at 941-745-1490, 941-745-1490, and give us a report. I'll leave you cell phone. You could actually give us a report, get a video, and then send it to me through Facebook.com at Henry Rain Show, and we'll post it up on the Facebook page too. You can find us, as I just said, I will tell you again redundantly, that we are on Facebook at Henry Rain Show, also Twitter at Henry Rain Show. Where are you on?
I don't know. I guess I'm going to get an email address or something. I'm happy to be on the Henry Rain Show if you didn't realize that's where we were. Actually, I had an opportunity to have a man on the street at the Van Buchanan Town Hall meeting. We're going to have to work this out. My wife, Joan, volunteered to go down there. I was going to drop her off and pick her up later, sometime this afternoon. And she's going to call in, but at first we just...
Somebody on 41 give her a ride, I'm sure.
I have no doubt. So next time we're going to work this kind of thing out, and we'll have a...
I don't know if there'll be another next time after Vern faces the community on this. Which leads us to one of the main topics today is how does the American Health Care Act, the Republican House reform, how would that affect you and your local community here in Manatee County, Sarasota County, all of Tampa Bay? But another big issue in the news is the alleged Obama wiretap of President Trump. Angela Merkel listened to Donald Trump talk about that in their joint press conference, if you want to call it a press conference, more of interrogation of Donald Trump and his allegations by German media. But I want to come to Donald Trump's defense because, it took me a while to get the old investigative journalism staff back together for the Henry Rain Show, but we have uncovered an actual Obama wiretap with President Trump. It's not imagination. It's the real audio. It took us a long time, up until 3 a.m., playing my sources. Dennis Miller, the editor of BillionTimes.com, he knows about playing sources and working them until the wee hours of the morning. And, let's not waste any more time. Let's go ahead. It's actual audio of a Donald Trump phone call that was wiretapped by President Obama.
Yes, who is it?
Donald J. Trump is calling.
What have I done?
We have losers.
What I do? I didn't do nothing. What I do?
Somebody has to come out and tell it like it is.
What I do? I didn't do nothing. What I do?
I don't think so. No.
Now, let's not be hasty, fearless leader.
I've been watching you for the last couple of weeks. We're ready to start shooting.
I would do various things very quickly.
Not be hasty, fearless leader, old buggy boy, Smitty Pie. I can make it all up. I turn back all my metal, my mortgage and the Pentagon, and last but not least, my autographed picture of Sonya Tofts. No, on second thought shoot, I'd rather die than part with it.
Donald, are you talking to someone?
Nobody.
Is somebody in there with you?
Nobody.
Donald, I'm coming in.
That was close, Natasha.
Well, I think that pretty much says it all right there.
I can't wait to hit the mainstream media.
I can't wait for President Trump calls. Probably even give me a flight up to... Mar-a-Lago this long weekend. I can't imagine him waiting till Monday to send me to the White House.
At the very least.
But I think now is the best time to bring in not just the editors of BrandonPrice.com, but an accomplished author in his own right of fiction and short stories, novels, etc. That, of course, is Dennis Miller. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Henry. Thanks for having me back.
Let me try that audio on you again. We got you through. It's just the levels are a little different from mic to mic here. So, tell us, remind us of the names of the books, because you've got two out on.
Yes, I had a novel that came out in 2015 called The Long Road Home, and then in December, my second book, a short story collection called Casting Shadows, was released.
Uh-huh. And how are those available?
You can get them both on Amazon.com. That's the easiest place, probably. A couple of independent bookstores.
In the car.
Yeah, back of the room sales is what it's called, so we have to meet outside afterwards.
Not the back of the room.
Not self-published books, not to be confused. Indie media, though. Small time still, but doing well.
Congratulations on that, and also congratulations... Long-time WWPR listeners remember a young man, a young boy, really, when he first made his radio debut, Sullivan Maley. How old was he when he first came on here?
He, I think, was 5 or 6 the first time we had him on the show.
And what's he doing now?
He turned 13 yesterday, so I have a teenager in the house. And he's continuing to do very, very well. He's finishing up middle school this year, and he's going to the University of Pennsylvania as a Jack Kemp Cook Young Scholar this summer.
Wow.
And he's played a lot of music, doing real good, making his dad proud.
That long ago, that was back when we had tubes and a mixing board.
Right.
We still have it.
I don't think it's changed yet. Which is good. We're happy about that.
You've got to be extremely pleased. That sounds like a very... very unusual, a very unique young man. So very talented. That's wonderful. Does he also have your writing abilities or writing abilities?
He has won a couple of writing contests already. He's pretty much going to pass Dad out with everything, probably before he starts high school.
I was listening to Alan. Did you mention the wrestling also?
He's also a state champion wrestler. They gave wrestling up this year to take on a second instrument and play in a second concert band. So the Renaissance band.
Good. Who do you wrestle for?
Manatee Kids, Manatee Hurricanes.
Oh, yeah. My son was a wrestler. And,
okay.
Yeah. He was running up JV here in the state.
Great.
So, yeah. A lot of fun. And I will say that you pay your dues when you are the father of a kid who wrestles, because you will go and watch him wrestle, and 6 minutes later, you...
12 hours, 6 minutes on the mat, 2-hour drive, yeah.
The only thing that equates to that is having a daughter doing dance. So... But they're wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
And sports for high school now?
I don't think so. I think maybe the sports parts are over. And I can't say that I'm disappointed at all in that. You know, when I look at it, Henry, one of the things I've seen being an athlete my whole life growing up, the environment that they're in. When I see him in the arts, he's around the best and most behaved kids. There are very compassionate
girls.
Right. But there are also very compassionate instructors. I can't tell you how often in sports I'd have to come home and re-educate him on something that was said, something that was said by a coach, how the mouse is proper way to talk to somebody, it's a proper way to motivate somebody. Seeing those two different worlds up close, I have to say I'm a lot happier to see him in the arts world than the sports world.
Absolutely, and the big problem we're having is, with these budget cuts, the federal funding, we're looking at big slashes in the funding for the arts, National Endowment of the Arts. I mean, we're not just talking millions, we're talking billions of dollars.
Yeah, a minuscule amount of the budget. This has always been just political hay in the sense that it scores you a lot of victory, a lot of points politically on the conservative side if you cut these things. But they're really straw men. You know, they are a rounding error in the budget that helps to, you know, expose children to the arts that maybe aren't on a level playing field, and helps to bring these things into venues that they're often not going to find their ways into in the typical markets. And it's unfortunate that those programs will be sacrificed basically for political pawns.
And before we move on to some of these issues in depth, tell us what's going on at the BillingsBlinds.com.
Well, you know, we are, as usual, the scourge of local special interests, and we are trying our best to keep up with all the rapscallions who are, you know, rape pillaging and plundering in the Minnesota area. So we're covering a number of stories right now, a lot of them having to do with development and phosphate mining, you know, two of the things that are very big politically in Manatee County. So you can check us out every day at www.thebradentontimes.com, and then if you sign up on our homepage for our emails twice a week on Thursday and Sunday, you'll get our email editions that will keep you up to the best hyper-local news that you might not see anywhere else.
Hyper-local.
Hyper-local.
Okay. Let me ask you, to keep your webpage and your programs running, is it a subscription program or?
It's not. No, it's ad supported, so it's free. So free access to local news.
You still have the email updates too?
The what?
The email updates.
Yes. I mean, Thursday and Sunday, the emails come out.
Okay, correct. All right, so you can keep up that way. You just go to the website and sign on and say it's clearly marked.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I do want to point out, Henry, also, because we have been off the air for a while, if you want to join us on the air, call in 941-745-1490. That's 941-745-1490. And I'll tell you right now, Henry Raines cannot, I'm sure things have never changed, ignore a ringing telephone.
A flashing light. But also, if you aren't listening to us right now, you could be listening to us on demand.
That's right.
At henrylaneshow.podomatic.com, streaming live at 1490wwpr.com. At least that is the...
That's sometimes happens.
It could be happening right now as we speak. And I know some people had a little problem last week, but I'm sure it's all been worked out now. But, of course, you can also access the Podomatic site, Podomatic.com site, to your cell phone, too. Smartphone, and you can listen.
Public and Bluetooth in your car.
Mm-hmm. You can have it all.
And also on Facebook. And we'll have pictures going up here later, I'm hoping. So...
And as we evolve week to week and anticipate anything that might slow us down, we'll get the Facebook Live going also at the same time. So we were talking about some of the budget cuts that were coming up. Many would be in the health care reform bill is enacted, although it may be doubtful if the Republicans get the House version actually through the Senate. But we have an update on that, and we'll take it up. As far as what it will mean to the local community.
We turn now to the proposed replacement for Obamacare. More than 20 million Americans wanting to know if they will keep the care they have. And tonight, the president declaring several Republicans who were on the fence, he helped convince today. But ABC's Mary Bruce in the hallways of Capitol Hill all day asking several Republicans herself. So a reality check tonight. Where does this stand? ABC's Mary Bruce on Capitol Hill.
Tonight, the businessman president is trying to close the deal.
It's coming together beautifully.
Huddling in the Oval Office today, the president said he's won over these Republicans.
I also want everyone to know that all of these no's, or potential no's, are all yeses.
But many of those members were already on board. Support tonight is growing, enough so that the House plans to vote on Thursday. But there are still a lot of no's that need convincing.
If they change the bill, I can be a yes by Thursday, but they'd have to change it substantially.
What will it take for you to get to yes?
They have to start over.
They have to start over completely?
Yes.
They could have a vote on this on Thursday.
Well, thank you.
22 no votes would kill the bill in the House, and by our count tonight, at least 22 have not committed to supporting it.
I'm still undecided.
Hoping to convince skeptical Republicans, the White House GOP leaders are promising changes, such as tweaks to funding for Medicaid and tax credits to buy insurance. The stakes are huge. Many Americans feel they could lose their coverage.
I can tell you, three members of my family, including me, that would be dead if it was not for ACA.
And they're not holding back.
Shame on you!
The Republicans and the president, the political stakes are also huge.
I want everyone to know I'm 100% behind this.
Mary Bruce with us live from the Hill tonight. Mary, even if the bill does get through the House next week, which you'll be following, it still faces an uphill battle once it gets to the Senate.
In the Senate, Republicans can afford to lose just two votes if they want this bill to survive, which means tonight, in its current form, this bill is already dead on arrival. David.
Mary Bruce with us on a Friday night. Thank you, Mary.
And, of course, courtesy of ABC News from last Friday. Yesterday, the report. So there's a lot to digest in the House version of the Health Care Act. I also want to just, as a point of background, let the audience know one of the things I've been doing on my hiatus is getting me involved in health care and practice management. Alan, of course, I think I have permission to say that you're licensed respiratory therapist. You work a lot in the ER.
Right.
And so you have a lot of firsthand knowledge of this. And here in Manatee County, we've been the Healthcare Advisory Board. Initially, it was looking at the expenditures of the county for medical need in the hospitals and some of the things like that. But what has happened over the past year, plus the members have been on there, is we've had a review of all the different services that medical needy might not be the appropriate term. There's needy, and then there's just people that don't have enough to cover everything that they may need. And we found out a lot about that. But I wonder if we can go to Dennis, and you might have I've covered this on thebraymantimes.com, I'm sure. What has been your observations as a journalist looking at the county and how they deal with health care needs in the county?
Well, look, you know, I was very critical of their effort to expand the indigent care service, and the reason for that was, you know, if you remember a few years back, I think we're looking at 2013, they tried a very expensive off-year special election to pass a special half-cent tax that would have run about $25, $30 million a year to spend, to basically turn over to private hospitals in order for, you know, saying, hey, thanks for taking care of our indigents. The very, very profitable hospital companies love this. There's a lot of misconception about what has to happen legally in terms of when somebody comes in and presents in emergency rooms. And a lot of people are aware that there's no law that says you've got to take care of somebody and stabilize them when they come into the emergency room. Any hospital cannot do that. Where that actually comes from is it's a tie-in if you accept Medicare and Medicaid dollars. So as part of the Medicare Act, they said if you take these funds, then you have to do this. So anybody cannot treat indigents if they stop taking Medicare. They complain about Medicare, it's low reimbursement all the time, but not one single hospital in the whole United States doesn't take it because there's a lot of money being shelled out. They can just make more money through private insurers. So the problem that we had was there was an effort to help with this by expanding Medicaid. That, of course, became a political football because everybody said, oh, we're not going to take the Obama dollars. We're not going to take the big government. We're going to do it on our own here. We're not going to contribute to the deficit, which is only apparently important when you have a Democratic president. So Florida, like many other states, turned those dollars away, billions of dollars away.
$5 billion a year.
Yeah. And they turn it away, and
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I also want to point out, we actually send those $5 billion
to the Treasury.
There are $5 billion. It's just like,
it's not going against the table. We don't accept it.
If you have a tax refund coming, you say, nah, keep it.
Right, exactly. Because it was spent elsewhere anyway. So you did not save from the corporate government. You just literally kept Floridians from getting their tax dollars sent back to them, and you had them going to other states. So a foolish political ploy that was. But then that also, one of the reasons why they said, hey, even when we cover 90% of your Medicaid expansion, it was 100%, and it was going to gradually get scaled down, but even at 90%, you're going to save money. And they said one of the three different nonpartisan studies
done that showed expansion will save money even once it's walked down. And the reason was you get rid of a lot of duplicative state and local programs. One great example being you wouldn't need to expand your local indigent care if you can get more of those people into Medicaid. So that was one of the great offsetters. So you had the same people. You had a Republican County Commission saying, we don't like Obamacare, don't expand Medicaid, but let us tax our local people who are already not getting your tax dollars sent back from Washington, as you pointed out. Let us further tax them to pay for something that those tax dollars never paid for. So it was a ludicrous partisan, you know, political football that made no economic sense in terms of how do we cover the most people and get the most treatment the most efficiently. What we're seeing, and this is always what I said about this subject, Henry, and this is really my summary of it, is we're all paying for it anyway. Until we have a system where, you know, some woman comes in with a kid and she's in a car accident, and we say, you got no insurance, you need to pay, you're going to bleed out in the waiting room. Until we have
that would be better.
You know, until we have this Dickensian, you know, type of society in which we do that, we're paying for it anyway. So when somebody comes in and they don't have the means to pay, then, as you know, the fees for service go up, and then the premiums for the insurance of the uninsured goes up. So every one of those costs are spread across. They don't say, hey, no dividend this quarter. They don't say, hey, we're just going to let our stock price go up. Those costs are spread around the economy to the rest of us. So we're all paying for the same thing anymore. People say, I shouldn't have to pay for you. We're all paying for it. It's the way healthcare works. The reality is we're currently paying for it in the least efficient and most expensive way possible.
And in a moment, I want to tell you about something that I investigated along with others, but actually interviewed some other communities, where we could have gotten this off the tax rolls. And not financed it with U.S. tax dollars, you know, the county's tax dollars. And I remember in one meeting, one of the more sensitive members of the board was saying, well, how would the community feel about whatever the situation would be with these people and their kids? And I said, well, the community, if they're not stepping over sick people on the sidewalk or seeing their tax bill go up, they're not going to feel anything at all about it. But I want to go down Cross here because he has firsthand experience in the ER. Before you tell us about that, Alan, at one point, one of the other things that came to our attention in the board meeting was there's either four or five dialysis patients, kidney dialysis, they go to the ER once or twice a week for the dialysis because they don't have health insurance. And, of course, those costs are first absorbed by the hospital and then passed on to the taxpayers through whatever mechanism we have. And I would just guess, Alan, that that's probably at least $250,000 per patient willing for dialysis for a year-long period going through the ER.
I really have no first-hand knowledge of the dialysis patients and their costs, but I can tell you how people are handled in the emergency rooms. In both the local hospitals here locally, when somebody presents and they're critically ill, they're not turned away. They are going to be seen. And they're going to be seen either they're coming in with the flu or they're coming in with a limb hanging off. And what happens in our area hospitals, and our hospitals, those patients, especially the critically ill ones, are going to be admitted to an ICU, and then they may have a problem with discharge as they improve because they still need follow-up care, but they have no insurance. So the air tax, assisted living facilities or the skilled facilities that are super specialized that can take care of these people can't take them and won't take them because they have no insurance. And so this becomes a real problem. So you actually have patients, and I'm saying you are now in the area of hospitals, you probably got at least maybe three or four of these hospitals, a lot of them, that have a patient in there right now they have had for months. And this still requires care, nursing care, drugs and medications. They still get everything they need at increased cost to the hospitals. And I think this is what you and I are talking about. First-hand knowledge of critically ill patients, because I do work in a very active emergency room. When they hit our back door, you know, we never hear anything about insurance or cost of life or what have you. They come in, they get treated as they need to be treated. CAT scans, MRIs, rush to surgery, follow-up surgeries, intensive care.
And how many of those things are avoidable if they had access to preventative medicine?
Well, so, you know, some of the ones that I deal with have a lot of accidents and gunshots and that kind of stuff. But there are a lot of them. I walk down into the emergency room and have a patient sit up on the side of the door. Oh, hi, Alan. I go, hi, Bill Mab. Yep, I'm here to give you a nebulizer treatment again.
Right, right, right.
That's your
I hear all the time about diabetics looking in, and they just don't have access to getting their insulin regularly. If you don't, you're going to end up in the emergency room at some point. Best case scenario, you're just getting baseline treatment. Worst case scenario, you're in a diabetic coma. We're looking at an amputation at some point. You have a foot. All these things are immensely expensive, and they contribute to the overall growth and the cost of the system. And that's one of the things that this basic new Trump Care, American Health Care Act, one of the things it doesn't address is that it is so much cheaper to treat these things up front than it is on the back end. But you, if you have to treat them on the back end, all you're going to do is continue to drive the growth of that price.
Well, when we look at what the status quo is right now with Obamacare and what the future could hold, I do want to talk to the people, the residents of Yankton County and nearby also, because for all the complaints about this county and how the local government does this or that, there are some things that are really best practices that Manatee County is a model for the rest of the state and beyond. One quickly is that the wellness program for county employees is very advanced and very active in reducing health care costs for the 7,000 employees. People may not realize there's 7,000 county government employees, so that adds up. Another place that we are just exceptional in the new program, and it speaks to exactly what both of you are talking about, is the new paramedicine program that the paramedics are running here. And I'm going to ask the question, perhaps rhetorically, if I've already asked either of you this before, but I want you to give maybe the audience that is listening just a moment to try and digest this. And so there is a target population that the paramedics are compiling, and it's basically based on who is a frequent flyer for the emergency service to the ER. Now, I would ask the audience Alan and Dennis in the studio to get put on that list. How many times a year do you think you have to use the ambulance? Have I asked you this before, Alan?
Yeah, we talked about it.
Yeah, so let me ask Dennis then. How many times a year do you think you have to use an ambulance to go to the emergency room to be put on a list where there's going to be some follow-up?
Let's say 36. Three times a month.
You already know this.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, it is. That's exactly it. Most people would say, 12 times a year? That would be a high level.
Well, I do have the advantage of knowing how many of those high, much higher numbers they have. But no, I did not know that.
It's three times a month is considered a frequent flyer. If you're only using it two times a month,
we're not. If you had a neighbor who, every 2 weeks, an ambulance has shown up and cutting them off because they're incredible.
We don't have time for them yet.
That's not bad enough. Right.
And so what happens is when this person is identified, then there are two paramedicine paramedics that will call on that individual at their house and do an interview, try and understand what's going on. And typically, if you put aside drug overdoses, which is a huge problem here in this county, but may not be something that your local primary care doctor is prepared to deal with. But as you said, diabetic complications, as Alan well knows, breathing problems, COPD, frequent falls, all these things are something that a little bit of attention can really reduce costs, improve the quality of life for the individual patient, because they get into some kind of primary care mode of maintaining their health. Now, the other thing is we have looked at in the board is how do you get these people onto insurance? Now, there's a lot of misconceptions about the healthcare marketplace, and I want to be very clear to people that are listening and maybe haven't looked at this before. When you hear the Republican congressman or local representative, I'm sure you hear from Vern Buchanan at the town hall meeting about that this is failing, that it's collapsing. Those just aren't the facts. More people are covered, less there is less choice in the marketplace, but for the actual individual that has, say, an income of $24,000, the quality really hasn't changed that much for you. And this is something I dealt with by the work, because they deal with people who made certain choices in the exchange and may not have done it efficiently. One of the things with this, how do we reduce the uninsured in the county? Well, first off, you have to overcome some of the prejudices, or biases, I should say, not prejudices, biases of some individuals thinking that it is what the politicians say, that it's high deductibles, high co-pays. So I actually brought my computer to the subcommittee I was looking at and said, has anybody actually gone? Because I've shopped on the exchange, and my daughters have shopped on the exchange. I don't know if you have.
No, I'm very lucky.
I actually was able to sit through someone else as they did it, so I did the exposure to the problem.
So an individual, just hypothetical, male, about $20,000 for this current year, 2017, could have gotten insurance for $100 a month, $3 specialist copay, $1 primary care copay, and $900 out of pocket. Think about these people that are using high utilizations, or even not so high, $3,000, $4,000 a year, but it's falling back on taxpayers. Well, whether it's the dialysis patients or something else, we're like, it would be cheaper just to buy them insurance.
Right.
It would solve so many problems. And when we look at other communities, and I want to give Ray Fusco, who also sits on the board, who has managed health hospitals, and he was an administrator for Maine County Rural Health, or MCR as it's called now, he knows where this is going on, and I actually called some of these places. In Port Logan, in a seven-county region, the hospitals and other healthcare providers are kicking into a 501c3 foundation, non-charitable organization, to buy the insurance. And what's happened over the last few years is they started out with the people that were just outside the Medicaid, the expansion of Medicaid. And now they're paying for it all the way up to 200% of the poverty level because it's so successful. Hospitals are getting a return on their investment, you know, probably by tenfold, I'm thinking. It would not be hard knowing the rate and fee schedules for a lot of things. For a high utilization patient, if you spent $1,200 for their insurance, you're going to bill out a lot more than $1,200.
There's no doubt about that, and I think it was spot on. The thing that I was always intrigued with when Obamacare was coming online was the new healthy people, the younger people, were there going to be enough of those signing up to compensate for the adverse selection? Basically, the people are going to be rushing in right away to get it. And so all of a sudden, the health insurers have all these sick people they've got to pay for, but they're not getting enough healthy dollars.
And to be fair to the Affordable Care Act, I think we only had 1 year with the full penalty in by this point. So I think
that's one of the points that it's finally kicking in.
They did that slower than they originally had anticipated in order to engender more support for it because people obviously don't like it.
And I heard the CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Florida say, and then once you get them on, it takes them about 2 years to get used to having health insurance and improving their health. But
hospitals are creating some programs, I mean, that are trying to decrease the number of patients that are being readmitted. But the cynicism rates are constantly being monitored because if you're on Medicare and you're discharged from the hospital, if you get readmitted to the hospital within 30 days with that same diagnosis code, that hospitalization is not going to be paid for. So it benefited the hospitals to create programs to follow up on these patients outside the hospital to make sure they're taking that. I'll go back to my area of expertise, make sure the chronic owners are using their breathing machines, they're using their steroids, they're using all the medications properly, they're in a smoking cessation program, and trying to keep them out of the hospital. But I see it all the time. A patient is discharged, and 2 days later, sometimes one day later, they're back in again. Not through any fault of the doctor discharging them too early, it's just that they cannot support themselves or kill themselves.
Not necessarily the best way. I mean, it's a good incentive. And when you look at Obamacare, you know, there was its foundation. It was a very, very good study done by Dartmouth University called the Atlas study. And one of the great things, because we've got to kind of come back to this individual mandate because it's such at the core of this debate, one of the great things about Medicare and Medicaid is they forced providers to collect a tremendous amount of data. And then we have, through them, a tremendous amount of knowledge in terms of how care is working effectively and efficiently and how it's not. So one of the things the Atlas program was what they set out to do, was to look and say, how come it's so different in terms of the expense for a certain condition in this zip code and that zip code, and it didn't really correlate to cost of living. They said, okay, we would assume that the most expensive place to get a back surgery is, you know, San Francisco or Manhattan, and they're not finding that. They're finding these little rural counties where it's more expensive. They're saying, why is more money being spent here than there? And as they started to do it, they started to see, what we're really missing here, one, is the standardized best practices. We're not sharing enough information. We're not saying what works and what's cost-effective, and then let's try to encourage everybody to kind of follow that pathway. So the idea originally, the group from this, was how about we create this big commission and put on it insurers and doctors and nurses and other healthcare providers, hospital managers, and say, let's evaluate this data and see that if we do this first, you know, procedure A that's less expensive than procedure B, and we try that first because it works in 50 or 60% of the cases before we go on the most expensive one, because maybe there's a perverse incentive if the insurance are covered, do the expensive one first and get reimbursed for it. What if we kind of standardize the practices that the data tells us are the best way to handle something? Well, that became your death panel. That's what your death panel was. It was a bunch of people studying best practices and putting in, and there were exceptions. There were all kinds of latitudes for the doctor to say, well, not in this case. And here's why we're going to step C right after that. But it was an effort to say,
so almost every insurance company that currently insures you does.
Yes, exactly. So we don't want the government, you know, decide whether grandma gets care, it's going to be a death panel, they're going to be rationing health care. Insurance companies ration health care now. You know this. You know, when somebody says, I want this, they say, oh, well, that's an experimental treatment in our plan, so we don't cover that, we cover this. You know, they look at it and they say, if something's $100,000 and it gives you a 51% chance, but this is $15,000 and it gives you a 49% chance, we're going to just stick with the, you know, we can live with 2% lower at that kind of savings. So you had an effort to do that. Now, when you go to the mandate itself, you go all the way back to the early 90s when Hillary Clinton was first lady was trying to you know, do health care, and you had the Conservative Heritage Foundation suggest this. This was endorsed by Newt Gingrich. This was a conservative approach and saying, listen, until we get these freeloaders, and what they meant by that were the young, well-employed people who could afford a policy, but say, hey, I never get sick. Why don't I want to buy insurance? You know what I mean? That's a drag. I'd rather put that into my Mustang or whatever, right? We got to get them in the system because they're freeloading. They're only coming in later when they're sick. Insurance doesn't work that way. You're supposed to pay in when you're low risk and then benefit when you're high risk. They're freeloading. They're just going into emergency rooms and have care, and they're not paying the bills, and they get stuck on the rest of us. Individual mandate. Well, again, when it became, hey, Democrats said, hey, why don't we throw this Republican thing in? I'm going to say, oh, they didn't do this. Why don't we throw in this Republican thing to help make it work but and incentivize, mandate really all of the young and healthy people you need in a successful risk pool, get them into it. They said, oh, no, we can't do that. That's socialist. That's un-American. So, I mean, that's one of the things you're looking at. You know, I heard this week the right to not have insurance. We don't even have a car insurance. I can't just drive my car around willy-nilly, and if I crash into your brand-new BMW, you say, ah, sue me. You know, you can get a judgment against me, but you're not going to get your car fixed. Well, the whole principle of buying cars, insurance cars, and driving cars on the road, that whole system doesn't work if I can drive a big, you know, dangerous, you know, couple thousand pound weaponized, you know,
assault vehicle.
Right. And I can do damage to yours, and then you can't have any real recourse if I wreck it and you've got a finance or such. The whole thing kind of falls apart if we don't say, hey, you want to play in these highways, you got to have insurance. Well, the healthcare thing works the same way.
We could go on a lot about this, but we also have to look forward. A couple of things to close up the loop on the current status quo with the Affordable Care Act. We sort of started the discussion with how the county, Manatee County, deals with people that don't have the facility, the insurance to pay the health care. And I think people need to know what the actual pool is, the best estimate of the number. The millions of dollars that we've been spending over the years for, you know, for lack of a better term, indigent care, it really isn't indigent care. These are working families many times that have a home and just don't have the wherewithal to have healthcare coverage, is about 700 people in this county of over 300,000. 700 people is what we're talking about. We've talked about how they could have insurance if we implemented a program like other communities have, although now we won't have the opportunity in 2018 to get these people on there. But
700 people, if you just go that math backwards, what we were talking about before, at about $100 a month premium, and say $1,000 out of pocket, we're looking at $2,200 for an individual. For 700 people, what does that come to? 1.4 million?
We're spending about 15.
Yeah.
On the basic
plan. So it could be much less and much more efficient. Now, speaking to your point about the so-called death pounds and what happened, we have an example of that right here in this county. This is what I'm talking about. We have some of the best practices in Manatee County. Manatee County Rural Health Services, now called MCR, is what's called a qualified health provider under the Obamacare Affordable Care Act. What that means is they can't turn anyone away. Similar to what you said about the emergency room, if you show up at a doctor's office, they'll give you an appointment and they'll treat you. What their incentive for doing that is if they can show that their outcomes are better and they're treating the people that don't have insurance, the reimbursement for Medicare and Medicaid is increased. They get more than the standard rate. They have become so efficient at doing this that they're able to treat the people that don't have anything, which the average, if my memory is correct, is about $9 is what they get from those patients that don't have insurance. $9. Not $9 and $9 and $9. $9. But they're able to take care of them with the excess, and their outcomes for the Medicaid patients are better than the rest of the community. So there's one example. Another thing I want to point out to people before we look at the Republican plan, or the House Republican plan, is the decrease in abortions. Conservatives, right-to-life people, must be happy when there's less abortions. And I know they want zero, but actually, we've had an 18% decline in the abortion rate since the Affordable Care Act because of the mandatory contraception. And that pretty much sums it up right there. So that's going to go away. So that's one thing to think about. Now, when we look at the health care plan of the Republicans, we aren't going to get the subsidies based on income anymore. It's going to be based on age. For someone like myself, or Alan, you get your health insurance through your employer, though.
Correct, yes.
Yeah. I'm a small practice, so there's a consideration that I go through the exchange. I'm going to see a premium next year, if nothing changed, and they pass the House Act, for a 6-year-old of about $14,000 a year for health insurance premium with a $4,000 tax credit. And I get to that tax credit because I don't think you get it if you don't have the income.
Hopefully do. What I'm looking at, though, too, Henry, is we're starting a program under the same premise that we've seen so many others collapse or come near collapse, which is the idea that we're going to base it not on need. It's ludicrous. You're going to have, people of considerable financial means that we get this subsidy, and when you're looking at a problem as big as this, that sort of waste is really unacceptable.
And then, also, taking this back to a topic earlier in the show, as far as the Medicaid expansion and what's happening here. So, we did not take the extra $5 billion to expand Medicaid. Under the new plan, and the debate is whether to cap the population under Medicaid by 2018 levels or 2020 levels. But whatever it is, it's going to be the federal government is going to give approximately 61% going forward after that, 61% of the dollars, and it's going to be capped. It's not going to grow with population. One of the things that people don't understand, unless you're actually really using it, is the Medicaid use by children in the state of Florida. 41% of the children in Florida get their health care through Medicaid. And I misread last night when I spoke to you, Alan. It's actually half of all births in the state of Florida are Medicaid paid for. So if we cap that, and as the Republicans don't want to maintain the system that has been in place for decades, the cash crunch that's going to come down on the taxpayers of Florida is incredible.
I mean, it's closer to what
more people, when you look at the wealth gap, more people are a larger percentage of people are falling under the impoverished umbrella every single year. So not only is population growing, but more and more of the percentage of that population is going to be qualified for that CAP program that now has a fixed amount of revenue coming in.
Right, and then we're also going to come to the point of, are we going to take care of the new births?
Well, no, just like the failure to expand, it will come back on the states and communities. So there is, you know, they always say there is no free lunch. There's no way, and that's why this pie in the sky, it's going to be great, everybody's going to be covered, what is it we're going to do, that you're going to get everyone covered, more people covered, lower premiums, and better treatment. How is that going to happen? It is difficult. It's been this difficult. It's this kind of hodgepodge now because it's so complicated and there's so many moving parts. But when you look at it and say, well, we're just going to take a whole bunch of money out of it, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to say what's going to happen. Less and less people are going to be covered. The expense then is going to be caught, hopefully, by communities and states at a much less efficient level. Medicaid operates at a high degree of efficiency, and as you demonstrated through the example of rural health, that is a way in which the federal dollars and the federal incentives can return that tax dollars to a community, and it can work very efficiently. We're moving away from that, not toward it. Doesn't take a genius to figure out the results are not going to be good.
And we have first senators, at least, that say they will not vote for the Republican American Health Care Act that's in the House. And we had four Republican governors come out in the last 24 hours with an alternative plan, including John Kasich of Ohio, but the governor of Michigan, and two other states that escaped me right now.
I've got one of them in Florida.
Or Texas. And that goes to my point, is that even the most conservative governors, Kasich has been vocal about this because he sees what it's going to do to him. He was somebody that took some political heat for saying, I'm going to take the expansion. A lot of Republicans said, you know, during that time, the Tea Party element really tarred and feathered him over that. But the reality was he had to deal with a mess that was left that he didn't. And he didn't want to be in Rick Scott's shoes saying, yep, really sorry that we can't cover you guys, but... The good news is we didn't take the money.
He wouldn't be the one having to deal with it. It's going to be his successor.
Right.
It should be in the second term.
Yeah.
So it actually, it seems to...
They see it, though. They see what you have and how you have to deal with it and the idea that it just doesn't go away. You know, it's like if I have a fever and you take away my thermometer, I might not be able to show I have a fever anymore, but the fever's still there.
Absolutely. But, you know, I mean, we've seen turning up the heat on these guys right before. For example, in Indiana, we had a governor that came out and just horribly vocal on the LGBT rights, and they got a lot of heat. We made him vice president. What's so frustrating, and I've seen this over the years, I've been in the healthcare community all my life. I started as an early when I was 16 years old. I told somebody that I've been a respiratory therapist for so long, that was when we were squeezing oxygen out of rocks, okay? So I've been kicking around this for a long time. First-hand knowledge really when I ran my own medical equipment company. And what I saw was the federal government getting more and more and more involved. The industry shrinking until they finally put me out of business because I couldn't do it anymore on what they were willing to pay me. And then they came with competitive biddings. And they said, you get the bid, you get the business. Well, wait a minute. You know, we all bid, but, gee, you know, and we didn't get the bid, but how about if we agree to accept what you're offering? And I go, no. And so it put, at one time, we had 2,200 medical equipment companies in the state of Florida. And I'm not going to say this was a good thing, because a lot of fraud and abuse and other things going on in Florida, the associations cracked down. We put in licensure, we put in accreditation, and we got rid of these bad guys. These bad actors left. We started making something sure a long time ago, started knocking on doors. Are you really in business? Or is that a sign out front, just a storefront? There's a storefront. And these guys went away. And I'll tell you why it was so lucrative, especially in Miami, because we had the mafia involved. You know why? Because the penalty to go to prison was a lot less for Medicare fraud than it was for drugs and prostitution and some of the other bad stuff they were doing. But it put all the moms and pops out of the industry, and it's still happening. So then we turn around and go, okay, now let's do this Medicare Part B. Hey, we're going to do this drug thing, and everybody's going to get drugs. Well, let's do the donut hole, but that, we'll work around that. And the Republicans sit on the floor of Congress, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was up watching it, which tells you I really have no life.
program, and I'm watching them say, and the federal government, as part of this program, cannot interfere with using their buying power to reduce costs. But what's the point? If you're going to sell to one of the biggest consumers in the world, at least have
the... The same way the VA does now.
I don't want to pay that much for that pill. You're going to give me that pill cheaper because I'm the federal government, and I got a gazillion recipients. Didn't do that. So the pharmaceutical companies got to charge whatever they wanted and forced seniors now into Medicare Part D. And you see this, and it just trickles out and out that further and further and further.
Now, and it creates a perfect segue for, I guess, our closing news article here. This came out yesterday.
An hour's almost gone.
Yes, it went by very quickly today.
It always does when I'm here.
Well, that's one in a row.
That's right.
And you'll be here every other Saturday.
Every other Saturday.
You'll have to heal the sick and
say the room. I'm a blind walk and a couple say yes.
Yes.
Something like that.
Yesterday, Preet Bharara. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Yes. Bharara was the New York U.S. attorney that was fired. He refused to resign recently when the order came out from Attorney General Jeff Sessions. And speaking to the people that we have overseeing the bad guys that you were talking about, Alan, was asked along with 45 other prosecutors to resign. Well, it's come out that he was overseeing a probe into the stock trades by Human Health and Service Secretary Tom Price. That's what ProPublica reported. He's been personally busy promoting the Republicans' health care reform, but also maintains he did nothing illegal when he traded health care stocks, even as he was involved in legislation while serving in the House of Representatives. In December, the Wall Street Journal reported Price traded more than $300,000 worth of shares in health care companies over a recent four-year period. At the time, he was taking action in Congress that would have affected those companies.
Isn't that insider trading?
Maybe not.
No, that's why he knew
he didn't sign the Congress until 2 years ago. But it's a perfect example. These are the people that were supposed to be doing that of the swamp. These are the examples that Trump gave on what we were going to have. And it's just one more appointee who is really resistant to the aspect of his department in terms of what they're supposed to do.
Well, we're not going to have time to go into it today.
That's a real shame.
But, well, actually, we could run over to
the so this is a big story. But look at this. You've got Pruitt, you've got Price, you've got DeVos, and you've got, there's three left
on our secretary
that have been demonstrated to have lied under oath in their confirmation hearings. So you have these people saying one thing when something else is happening. There is
Sessions.
That would have... Yes, Sessions. So it's four. That was...
You just got to tell me who was lying.
Jumping the gun on it. Any appointee ever in history, that's where the bonds come. And that you can lie under oath in your Senate confirmation hearings. They can demonstrate, here, you demonstrably lied, and then you still get to stay. I mean, that talk about how bad this must have been what it was like when Rome was falling.
I remember, I want to get into that on our next show about the pharaohs that when they came into power went back and chiseled the faces and features and names off of the pharaohs that came before them. It seems like we're seeing that now with Pharaoh Trump chiseling the names and faces of anything even remotely has anything to do with Obama. And that's why all these programs are being targeted. It is because somewhere in there is Obama.
And very dispassionate, we see he is on the health care. You can see how disinterested he is in that idea. He just wants it to go away. This is one of the hard parts of, you know, and when he said, oh, for 7 years they wanted to appeal it, and they never had a plan, what's to replace, and they never showed us. That's why. Nobody really, and that's the other part of Obamacare that should not be so short, is that it's a very complicated, difficult, unfun subject to tackle, and it was tackled, and something was done, and it needs to continue to improve, but there's no appetite to do anything other than, let's wash our hands of it, done, we cut this, and this, fixed, let's move on to something else. It's not that simple, folks.
The openness in this administration, I'm not saying to being corrupted, but the opportunity for corruption is incredible, because not only do we have President Trump's business interests, but Bloomberg News had an article this week about the Chinese investor that wants to buy into Jared Kushner, Ivanka's husband and President Trump's son-in-law, the office building in Manhattan, or
least New York City, I'm sure is considering the price, it must be in Manhattan, to the tune of $400 million, which will remove Jared Kushner from the liability of the mortgages, but still retain the 20% ownership of the project. This same Chinese businessman had to go under scrutiny before his other investments in the U.S. because of national security issues. And I don't believe all of them were approved. Are you familiar with the story, Dennis? And I wonder how much scrutiny this deal is going to come under. And it makes President Clinton, with what he did for the foundation, and there were certainly questions about that. I can remember doing a story where he took a Canadian businessman to Uzbekistan to try and get in on the uranium trade. And he got that deal, and the Clinton Foundation got $35 million. But there's at least an arm's length distance between that. When you're actually buying the physical assets of the person at the inflated price, or like the, as Rachel Maddow reported, the Palm Beach piece of property that Trump bought for $40 million, that the Russian oligarch that's the fertilizer king bought for $100 million and tore down. This is like nothing we've ever seen as far as the potential to be the kind of global crony capitalism.
I think we've seen it. We've seen it in Moscow. So when you look at a lot of those oligarchs and you look at how the state was divvied up and then how the state's resources and interests were profited off of based on who you know, I think there's a lot more in common with that regime than just...
Let me also point out that during the Obama administration, with the Ukraine crisis, that Joe Biden's son became the counsel and on the board of directors for the Ukrainian natural gas company. What did Joe Biden's son know about the legal implications of Ukrainian national gas? Joe Biden's son was also partners in an investment group with John Kerry's son. So it's there, but it's not a lot of this.
We're seeing it at a more brazen level than ever before.
Yeah. Dennis Manley has been with us all hour from the Brain from Pines.com. Tell us again about the novel and the short stories.
A Long Road Home is the novel, and the short story collection is Casting Shadows. Both of them are available on Amazon.com on Dennis Manley's page. And tomorrow, check out my weekly Sunday column. We'll talk about some of the good things that are happening with regard to citizens and citizen groups and environmental groups challenging things in court in Manatee County to try to get the regulators to do their job. But we'll also talk about why that's not an effective way to govern, governed by litigation rather than regulation.
What pages are the really steamy scenes in the novel on?
Right from the beginning.
All right, I like this. Yes. And Alan, thank you so much for returning to the studio.
I can't tell you how much fun I've had today. This has been a ball.
Yeah,
it's like I never left.
Things have been all over again. All right. Well, we want to thank Chris WWPR for giving us the studio to do this in, and we will be back next week. Not quite sure exactly what's on the agenda, but I'm sure it will be fascinating and interesting. And here we are going to
say, our offsite producer. I love him. I miss him every day.
Glenn Boniker. We're allowed to say his name now that he's passed,
and I'm sure he's still laughing at us.
I mean, I think he said his name on the air.